Welcome, everybody, to the Microsoft Azure webinar, Microsoft Azure for Enterprises, the what and the why. My name is Anusha Rangaswamy, and I'm a marketer with Microsoft Azure. It's my pleasure today to introduce today's guest speaker, David Chappell. David Chappell is the principal of Chappell & Associates in San Francisco, California. He's been the keynote speaker for more than 100 conferences and events on five continents, and his books have been published in a dozen languages. His consulting clients have included HP, IBM, Microsoft, Stanford University, Target Corporation, and many more. David is an international expert in cloud computing, and through his speaking, writing, and consulting, David helps people around the world understand, use, and make better decisions about new technologies. Today, David will share some insights into how modern enterprises are adopting Microsoft Azure. Welcome, David. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Anusha. And hello, everybody. Thanks for joining me today. What I want to talk about is how enterprises are adopting public cloud platforms. And my concrete example could be Microsoft Azure. We're going to focus on the what and the why, not the how. This is not a very technology-centric talk. Rather, what I want to do is walk through the main scenarios that I've seen enterprises use initially with public cloud platforms such as Microsoft Azure and why they are adopting them. That's the critical part, the why. So let's start. First of all, Azure is a public cloud platform. What does that mean? It means it provides computing resources accessible via the internet in data centers around the world. At the moment, there are Azure data centers in the US and Europe and Asia and Australia and Brazil, and there are more coming. Now, the minute any enterprise IT leader or business leader recognizes that using a public cloud platform like Azure means running their apps, storing their data in data centers owned by Microsoft, someplace else, maybe in some other country even, a couple of questions come to their mind right away. The first one is always this. The first one is always, gee, can a public cloud platform really keep my data and my applications safe? People say, what about security? What about security? IT leaders in particular look at this as a security question, because if your job is running a data center, then security of the data and the apps that use that data is your responsibility. Maybe you lay awake at night pondering whether your firewall settings are correct. You think of it as security because it is when you're running the data center. With a public cloud platform, however, people have to understand that this is not, in fact, a question of security. It's a question of trust. You have to learn to trust your public cloud provider. And the reason for that is simple. It is that you no longer have control of these things. Microsoft, for example, will let you tour Azure data centers. You can walk through. They'll say, look, over there, servers. Over there, more servers. What they will not let you do is examine the firewall settings. That'd be a security violation. You have to trust them. This is not really a security issue. Using public cloud technologies is a matter of building trust. And you're going to see that reality drives so much of the way in which enterprises begin using Azure. Here's the thing, though. I've talked to lots of IT leaders around the world about this topic, and what I find is that people are irrational. I'll talk to a CIO who will say things like, David, I would never put my corporate data in a public cloud platform. And then that very same CIO will send me information via OneDrive or Dropbox, both of which run on public cloud platforms. Or here's my favorite example. Ask yourself, what is the world's scariest technology? What is the world's most dangerous technology? Is it nuclear weapons? Is it some deeply engineered computer virus? No. No, the world's scariest technology, the world's most dangerous technology, is Windows Update. I mean, think about it. Every Patch Tuesday, Microsoft puts right in your operating system whatever code it feels like. How do you know that the last update or the next one doesn't steal all your data? You don't. We trust Microsoft. Think about this. Suppose later today it was announced that the government of North Korea had purchased the entire Microsoft Corporation. Unlikely, I know, but go with me here. Wouldn't you turn off Windows Update? I sure would. My point is, the level of trust we already have in Microsoft far exceeds what's asked of us by Azure and technologies like this. So, people are rational, and this question is really about trust. As we're going to see, building trust takes time. It takes usually small steps, and that's why the progression of adopting Azure is what it commonly is, as I'll show you later. But IT leaders then say to me, well, wait a minute. Okay, suppose I trust Azure. Suppose I do. Next question is this. Next question is, can I still meet my regulatory requirements in the public cloud? There are all these laws, all these constraints around what I can do. Can I still do those things here? Well, the answer is you have to understand the rules that apply to you, and you have to follow them. Now, the truth is lots of organizations just ignore this, especially business users. If they put data in OneDrive or Dropbox, that data may be stored in another country. Are they breaking the law? Possibly. Do they think about it? Probably not. Do I advise this? No. Especially when IT is using public cloud platforms like Azure, you got to think about it. And so grasping the rules that apply to you can be critical for some kinds of data. That can be hard to do. The reason it's hard is that the laws and regulations for off-prem computing vary across vertical markets, financial services, healthcare, retailing, government. They also vary across countries, US, UK, Singapore, Germany. The result is a matrix of laws and regulations, which frankly, no one in the entire world truly understands. Why? Well, it's complex, and many of those laws were made before cloud computing existed. What we're seeing, though, is that as the cloud continues its inexorable rise to dominance with SaaS applications like Office 365 and Google Apps, with cloud platforms like Azure, we're seeing more and more of these laws being rationalized and people learning how to work with them. So my experience is you can't do everything all the time today because of regulatory concerns, but most people I've spoken with who've actually walked down the path of grasping what the laws are and seeing what they can do, find they can do more than they thought they could. So I encourage you not to let this be a showstopper. I've started with the negatives here because people in their minds always do. People always have these questions. Getting them out of the way up front makes sense, I think. What I really want to talk about, though, is scenarios. How people use Azure and why. To do that, though, I have to now give you the world's shortest Microsoft Azure tutorial. It turns out you need grasp only a little technology to make sense of these scenarios. So here comes that very short tutorial. One category of Azure technologies is compute. In this, the most important service is probably this thing called IaaS, Infrastructure as a Service. All it means is you can go to a website, you can ask Azure to give you a new virtual machine. The image for that machine, the VHD, can come from Microsoft's gallery, their defined set of images, or you can supply it yourself. And it can be Windows, Windows Server, it can be Linux. Alternatively, you might use a service called Cloud Services, which offers PaaS, Platform as a Service. The idea here is that you can run applications that still run in virtual machines, but the VMs have cute names like WebRoll and WorkerRoll, and you no longer create the VMs explicitly. Instead, you give Cloud Services your app and you say, run my app. It's simpler, it's faster, and in some situations, it's better. I'll discuss that more later on. And there's one more PaaS technology called Websites, which is similar to cloud services in that you give it an app and it runs your app. You don't create VMs. But it's also different in some ways. So we'll talk more about IaaS versus PaaS later. The key point now is you're going to see most of these scenarios, most of how enterprises start using Azure is through IaaS, just virtual machines. You also care about data. And so there's something called blobs. Blob is an acronym for binary large object. It just means big chunks of binary data. Blobs are like a big sand in the sky. It's an important aspect of Azure. You can also run a regular relational database in an IaaS VM, SQL Server, MySQL. I think of this as IaaS relational storage. You notice something here. That you can run SQL Server on Azure should not be a surprise. That MySQL is also an option, perhaps is. Turns out that Azure's got a pretty strong focus on supporting open source. Earlier this year, Microsoft changed the name of this cloud platform from Windows Azure to Microsoft Azure. And my understanding is a big part of why they did that is to make clear that this is not just a Windows-based system. It supports Linux. It has a strong open source story. It's interesting. There's also a data option that's effectively PaaS. It's a managed relational storage called SQL Database. And one more thing. You all have data centers. Azure has data centers. You can connect those two things via VPN with a technology called Azure Virtual Network. This is interesting because it lets the VMs in Azure appear to be part of your own data center. In effect, they wind up having IP addresses from your IP address space. They look like they're just in your own network. Very nice way, in some cases, to connect your systems. And that's it. There it was, the world's shortest Azure tutorial. I'll show you a few more Azure technologies as we go along here. But you really need not grasp lots of technology depth to understand how and, importantly, why organizations are adopting public cloud platforms today. There's one more thing, though, that we have to do before we actually look at the scenarios, and that is we have to understand pricing. Pricing can be complicated, but the basics are pretty simple. And the reason we have to understand this is that in many of the scenarios, not all, but many of them, the why, the rationale for going there is about money. And so you have to grasp pricing to understand the rationale. So for most enterprises, there are three things that make up the majority of their Azure bill. First, compute. You pay for virtual machines, IaaS VMs, for instance, by the hour. You can see here the price ranges from 2 cents to $1.32 per instance per VM based on how big the instance is and what it can do. Bigger VMs, more memory, more CPU cost more. You also pay for storage. And there's options here. That nice managed relational service, SQL Database, costs between $1 and $10 per gig per month, because you're getting a lot of processing, SQL processing. Plain old blob storage, just random bytes in the sky, look at that, from just over 2 cents to over 6 cents per gig per month. Cheap. It's really cheap. And the third component of most enterprises' Azure bill is bandwidth. You do not pay for data transferred into Azure data centers. Microsoft is more than happy to take your data and then charge you to store it. They like that. Moving data out of data centers, however, Azure data centers, does cost money. You can see the prices here. It varies depending on how much you move. The more you move, the cheaper it is, and where data centers are, because bandwidth costs are different in the U.S. and Europe, Asia Pacific, and Brazil. So those price variations are, in fact, just pass-throughs of underlying bandwidth costs in those regions. These three things comprise the major issues of cost for most enterprise scenarios, most of the mainstream ones. Not all, but mostly. And one more thing. I'm sure a lot of you listening have enterprise agreements. If you have an EA, you'll never see these prices, because EAs commonly discount these prices. So With all of this as preamble, we now have the foundation to start walking through the scenarios, start looking at what public cloud platforms like Azure can provide. And as my subtitle here suggests, I will divide these scenarios into two categories: infrastructure, and then later, custom applications. We're going to start with infrastructure, and here's what we're going to talk about. The big scenarios that I see people using today look like this: data storage with blobs primarily, cloud identity, that's relatively new, it's important, VMs on demand, disaster recovery, deploying packaged applications, and it's not shown here, but also moving existing apps into the public cloud. So let's start with data storage. Most often, this means blobs. And so, an enterprise can use blobs in lots of different ways. There's something called Store Simple, which is in effect a SAN appliance for hybrid storage. I'll discuss that more in just a minute. You can also do backups to blobs with Microsoft technologies like Data Protection Manager. Plenty of third-party apps like Commvault also use Azure Blobs for backup data. And of course, apps that you build might use blobs as well for storing videos or the data they like to use. So blobs are really like a big SAN in the sky, just low-cost binary data. Of these options, the most popular today for enterprise scenarios appears to be, in my experience, appears to be Store Simple. And so it's worth taking a moment to look at Store Simple in just a little more detail. It looks like this. You've got users in your enterprise accessing their servers, running VMs with who knows what, SharePoint, all kinds of applications, file systems, whatever. They have probably their own SAN or some storage, but you can also roll in a Store Simple device. It's a piece of hardware that sits in your enterprise data center. It has local disk. But here's what it does. It moves data back and forth as needed to Azure Blob Storage. It compresses it, dedupes it, and encrypts it, critically. That encryption is really important because this is a big part of why people adopt this as their initial foray into Azure. You got to build trust, remember? People start kind of nervous. Having data be encrypted in the cloud makes them feel better. And only you have the key. Microsoft doesn't have the key. Think of Store Simple as acting like a cache, because that's what it is. It lets you keep frequently accessed data local while silently moving it back and forth as needed to the much lower cost blob storage. Why do folks do this? Well, I've just told you. Lower cost. Lower cost. Here's an example. Suppose that you want to store a terabyte of data in geo-redundant blobs. What that means is blobs that have a copy held in another data center, an Azure data center in the same region. It's essentially disaster recovery. And suppose you want to do 10 million reads and writes on your terabyte each month, and you want to move half the terabyte out every month. What would that cost you? Well, the storage, $61 a month. Operations, reads and writes, have a very small fee, you can see here. Data transfer, U.S. and Europe, $60 a month as well. Total, $121.50 a month in the U.S. and Europe for a terabyte of data stored in geo-redundant blobs. Now, I ask you, is that expensive? Is that cheap? I have done this talk for many organizations, many live audiences, and I ask the audience, is that expensive? Is that cheap? Universally, people tend to know their own on-prem storage costs. They look at this and they say, compared to my SAN, that's tremendously cheap. So this is why people are adopting technologies like Store Simple. It's a relatively safe way to start, data is encrypted, and there's an obvious cost benefit because blobs are so cheap. Another place at which enterprises are starting with Windows Azure is for cloud identity. And here's the idea. Today, most organizations run Windows Server Active Directory. It is also possible to have an IT admin in the enterprise configure a link with Azure Active Directory running on Windows Azure. Once that's been done, a user can log in to their on-prem Windows Server AD, like they always do. They can't tell the difference. And they can now, of course, have single sign-on access to on-premises applications, like they always do today. But they can also have access with no separate login to SaaS applications running on Azure. So that's cool. Single sign-on for on-premises and SaaS apps running on Azure. But there's something else here that's unexpected, perhaps, at least to me. You would expect that Microsoft would let people use Azure Active Directory to access SaaS apps running on Azure, of course. But Azure AD also lets you have single sign-on to other SaaS apps running who knows where. And in many ways, that's the most interesting part of the story. Because here's why people do this. They do it because Azure AD supports single sign-on to diverse SaaS apps. Of course, those from Microsoft, Office 365, Dynamics CRM Online, but also Google Apps, Salesforce CRM, ServiceNow, Dropbox, lots and lots and lots more. It's interesting. In some ways, it does for SaaS applications what Active Directory on-premises does for apps inside a Windows forest or domain. It gives you a single sign-on no matter who built the apps. Azure AD also supports multi-factor authentication. You can require a password plus a phone-delivered code to do logins. And it helps with administration. It gives you self-service password resets for SaaS apps, which for some companies is a huge cost saving. And it provides reports of who accessed which apps when and so on, which is useful as well. So cloud identity is also a common place to start using Azure. The reason is it solves a very real problem, single sign-on to diverse SaaS apps, and it's low risk. You're not putting much in the cloud. At most, only a hash of a user's password is kept in Azure AD. So, as I said before, building trust is important. Enterprises often want to start small, and so this can be a way to solve a real problem without taking what feels like too big a risk to many organizations. Another place enterprises often start using a public cloud platform like Azure is VMs on demand, especially using those IaaS VMs to create a dev test environment. It looks like this. An IT admin or developer can use Azure Virtual Machines, the IaaS technology, to create VMs, and a dev team can then happily use those VMs to develop and test new applications. And notice, those are regular VMs, Windows or Linux. So the apps they're working on can be running in the cloud or on-premises. This is not just dev test for cloud-based apps, no. What I show here is a relatively simple environment. You can also make this a little more complicated, a little more full-featured, by doing this. You can use the virtual network, as I showed you earlier, to create a VPN connection to make the VMs look like they're in your own data center. You can then also run Active Directory in those VMs. Do not be confused here. Just a minute ago, I talked about connecting Windows Server Active Directory to Azure Active Directory. This is not the same thing. You do that, what I just showed you, to get single sign-in to SaaS applications. Here, though, I'm trying to extend my on-prem data center to Azure to make it look like these VMs are part of my world. There, I may well want to run ordinary Windows Server Active Directory in a VM. Why? Again, single sign-on in my own organization, but I can make the Azure world look like part of my world. So here I really mean Windows Server AD. Once you've done this, I can again create VMs, and I can have developers or others use them. And here I have the very direct connection to the VPN. I have the single sign-in, the security of an AD connection. Why would I do this? Well, it's a fast and easy way to get inexpensive VMs. You saw how cheap they were earlier. You can use VHDs from Microsoft or your own, Windows or Linux, and users can potentially access these guys as if they were local, if you have a VPN connection set up. Now, the most common way to do this, the most common reason to do this, is dev test. But it need not be the only reason. Any kind of innovation, proof of concept project could benefit from this because the VMs are there quickly, they're cheap, and when you're done, you tear them down and stop paying. You need not provision actual VMs or worse yet, actual hardware in your own data center. And it's cheap. The Azure VPN connection is 5 cents an hour. So to have this capability available is not a big deal. And again, people often start here because a dev test environment is viewed as lower risk than a production environment. Maybe you only have test data in the cloud, for example, so you avoid regulatory concerns. It's a very common place to start using public cloud platforms like Azure. You can also use Azure for things like disaster recovery. SQL Server, for example, supports this idea of an always-on availability group, where a replica of your database can live somewhere else and be asynchronously updated as your application makes changes. Well, that replica can live on Azure, as the diagram shows. If your on-premises SQL Server system fails, your app can fail over, can be redirected to the cloud replica. You can keep on going. That's a relatively simple DR scenario designed just for SQL Server. There are more general ones as well. Azure has something called Azure Site Recovery that allows replicating Hyper-V VMs in the cloud. For using Hyper-V, you can do much broader DR. Why do this? Well, it's just cheaper. IaaS, VMs on demand, paid for when you need them, is such an obvious solution for disaster recovery, isn't it? With ordinary DR, you maintain a data center, hardware, that just sits there doing nothing, potentially, just in case. With IaaS, you can have maybe a couple of VMs running like pilot lights. When the disaster happens, you can spin up new VMs in a few minutes, 3, 4, 5 minutes tops, get your environment running again, and you can pay for things only when you need them. Doing disaster recovery with IaaS makes all the sense in the world once you're certain that the IaaS platform can support your scenario. Also, if you want, since Azure has these global data centers, you could have global recovery options just right built into the system. So this is an important scenario for any kind of IaaS technology, and I see enterprises begin their journey into the cloud by using this in Azure as well. Once people have built some trust, once they feel more confident that Azure is a platform they can use, they can bet on, they can really rely on, they start doing other things. The next time you want to deploy a new SharePoint farm, for example, you could deploy that on-premises, or you could do this. You could have your IT admin create virtual machines, IaaS VMs, and then just deploy the SharePoint farm on Azure. Your users won't know the difference. Especially if you do, as I've shown here, the things required to make the Azure Data Center look like your on-prem world, the VPN, the AD connections, this can just be an extension of your existing data center. Why would you do this? Well, once again, there are several reasons. A big one is faster deployment. You don't need to wait for central IT. If you're a business unit in a big company and you think you need a new SharePoint farm, and you go to your central IT people and you say, we'd like a new SharePoint farm, what will they say? Well, they will say yes, of course. But then they'll say, yes, and we'll get to it in 6 weeks or 6 months or 18 months or, depending on your organization, maybe even longer. If you deploy your SharePoint farm on a public cloud platform like Azure, you can start deploying this afternoon. because the VMs are there in 5 minutes. This provides a way for business units to not be bound by the constraints of central IT. And I know what some of you are saying. You're saying, well, wait a minute. You're saying, I am central IT. Yes, I know, you're central IT. And to you, this is a very bad thing. This is more shadow IT. You don't want this. I've got to tell you, though, even if your CIO is a graduate of the Joseph Stalin School of IT Management, you will not be able to stop your business units from doing this. You just can't. We work for them, remember? And so my advice is that you not even try. It's much more effective to try to help them, guide them, be the people who will help get this right, because you can do it anyway. You just can't stop this. Also, when organizations start deploying applications on pay-by-the-hour VMs, then IT resources become an operating expense, not a capital expense. You're not writing big checks up front to buy computers and storage and data centers. You're buying smaller checks, you're writing smaller checks every month to pay these monthly expenses. Now, there are some CFOs who love this idea. There are others who hate it. But depending on your environment, it's worth realizing that this is an important difference. IT becomes operating, not capital expense. And finally, lower cost. I showed you prices earlier. Azure is probably cheaper today than your own data center. And if it's not, I promise you, it will be cheaper tomorrow. Why? Because prices keep going down. Every time I do this presentation, the night before, I check the latest Azure prices because they change all the time and they never go up. The reason for that is simple. This is a competitive market with several big players fighting with each other. They're all selling quite similar things, IaaS VMs, blob storage. The result is serious competition and ongoing price cuts. 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, no rational CFO will let their IT people not use public cloud platforms. They're going to be so much cheaper than on-premises data centers. Finally, once people truly have trust in the public cloud, they start doing this. They start moving applications to the public cloud, like SAP. Today, SAP runs on Azure, although it's fair to say that people most often don't move production SAP to Azure. They instead move test environments or training environments, although you actually can, if you want to, in some cases, run production SAP on Azure. But why would you do this? Why would you move existing apps to the public cloud? You know the answer. I just told you. Lower cost. Here's an example. A relatively small app that runs in two medium-sized VMs has a relatively small database, 100 gigabytes. The pricing looks like this. U.S. and Europe, $2.80 a month. Now, earlier, when I asked about whether this is cheap or expensive for data, you probably knew. Most organizations I have found know their storage costs. But here, if you ask people whether it's expensive or cheap, they don't know, because people aren't used to pricing apps this way. And so to make good decisions here, you really have to know your current costs. I encourage you to start thinking about this, because you're going to want to move to a public cloud platform in the next few years, I believe. And to make the argument effectively, you have to know your current costs. And don't just think about buying a server. Comparing apples to apples means hardware, licenses, electricity, data center space, administration. It's a big deal. So, here are the scenarios that I see organizations most often use when they begin with Azure. And there's a progression. People don't start moving their apps, typically, until they've built some trust with simpler, easier scenarios. Nonetheless, these are the things I see most often for infrastructure. Now, How about applications? Here, for building custom apps, there are, again, a few choices. There are lots of ways to categorize applications. I've chosen three buckets: new employee-facing apps, new customer-facing apps, and in their own category, parallel applications. Let's start with employee-facing applications. Suppose you want to build a new custom app that automates, let's say, some internal business process. You might build that on IaaS on Azure. You create the VMs, deploy the app, the data. Your users are none the wiser. Your users are unaware that this is running on Azure. They don't care. They don't care. Why would you do this? Well, by this point, you know the answers. If you're a business unit, you don't need to wait for central IT to get you the resources. You can just build this and deploy it on Azure right now without waiting for VMs or, worse yet, physical servers from central IT. You also can get some capabilities from Azure that aren't otherwise easily available. Being able to run the app around the world, for example, easy up and down scaling. If the app has very varying demand, sometimes there's huge user bases, sometimes they're small, you can run more or fewer VMs and vary your cost based on demand. That's interesting. And again, lower costs. Today, maybe. Tomorrow, certainly. Public cloud platforms are just going to be cheaper than your on-prem data centers. I just showed you building an employee-facing app using IaaS. But recall, Azure also supports PaaS, cloud services, and websites. You could build your internally facing app on PaaS as well if you chose to. Why would you do this? What's the difference? Why use those PaaS technologies rather than IaaS? Well, if you recall, with PaaS, you don't actually create VMs explicitly. Rather, you say, platform, here's my app, run my app. It's faster, it's easier. When the app is running, the PaaS platform also maintains a large part of the environment for you, so your management costs are lower. And the third thing is, since you have fewer things to configure and manage, you have fewer things to screw up. So PaaS is lower risk. PaaS can be great for many new apps, although some developers don't always like it because PaaS constrains you a little bit. It gives you a platform that you must comply with. You don't have a raw VM to work with. Developers don't always like this. IT leaders almost always do, because getting apps up faster, having them cost less to run, and lower risk are huge wins. What about externally facing apps, those used by your customers? Here, let's say you want to build a new marketing app that's going to address your customer base around the U.S., around the world. You might build that on PaaS, Azure Cloud Services, or Azure Websites. Why would you do this? Why would you choose to build a new customer-facing app on Azure? Well, there's stuff you can get from Azure you can't easily get otherwise. The most important of those things is massive scale. For internally-facing apps, do you need massive scale? Probably not. Even really big companies aren't going to have more than a few thousand, a few tens of thousands at most, users at once on an app. But for apps that face the public internet, you might have vast numbers of users. That is a classic case for a public cloud platform. You also get easier scaling, better reliability, distribution around the world. There are services like a NoSQL service, which I didn't discuss earlier, built in. If you're building a customer-facing app on the internet, you ought to seriously consider making that a cloud platform-based app. And again, the cost is probably lower. And especially if you choose PaaS, you can probably build the app and deploy it more rapidly than you could on-premises or even with IaaS in a public cloud. In fact, the truth is that you can build almost any new app on Azure. But there are some scenarios where you ought to say to yourself, whoa, this is a classic case for building a public cloud application like an Azure app. If you see these characteristics, I encourage you, make a note. This should probably be an Azure app. If you, for example, need fast access to computing resources, VMs, storage, with no commitment, for example, a marketing website, got to be up tomorrow, and you're not sure how successful the campaign will be, that's a classic case for a public cloud platform. Or any kind of high-risk innovative app where you don't want to commit to hardware, but you also want fast access. That's a great cloud platform app. I said a minute ago, if your app requires massive or global scale consumer web apps, that's a great cloud platform app. If your app is very spiky, like say an app selling online tickets, where you might have a huge burst of demand when tickets first go on sale, then once they've sold out, demand drops far down. Well, that's a great cloud platform scenario because you can spin up lots of VMs to handle the spike and pay for them. Then when the spike is over, you can shut most of them down and stop paying for them. Makes perfect sense. Sometimes people choose public cloud platforms because they think it is a more secure option than running on-prem. What's an example there? One example is cloud backends for enterprise mobile apps. I've talked to a number of enterprises, for example, who've done this. They want to provide, say, a phone client that lets their customers access their own billing data directly or usage data of some kind. And that means going at the data in corporate data centers. And the guys who own that data say, I'm sorry, we're going to have customers' phones punching through our firewall? I don't think so. So what they do is move the data with regular updates to Azure. Run the mobile backend on Azure and let access happen that way. It's interesting. And finally, if you don't want in-house IT, and who's that? Well, startups. What startup today has a data center? Nobody. And also progressive businesses, those that understand that cloud computing really is the future. And to get there in 5 years or even 10 years, you got to start now. One more category of applications, parallel apps. With parallel apps, you're using a bunch of machines, in this case virtual machines, at the same time, all running in parallel. And you do this for two reasons. The first reason is you do it because you need lots of CPU power. That's commonly called HPC, high performance computing, and Azure supports that directly. Windows HPC Server lets you create on Azure clusters of VMs that can run parallel apps and get results to users. What's an example? Simulations. Bond portfolio simulations, for example. Car crashes. Things like that. The second reason for building parallel apps is you don't want lots of CPU power. Instead, you want to access lots of data. You want lots of disk spindles. And so that's a big data problem. For that, there's a popular technology called Hadoop. You can build a Hadoop cluster if you want to in an Azure IaaS VM set, but you can also use this service called Azure HD Insight, which automatically creates a cluster for you, lets you submit jobs in a variety of ways, they're called MapReduce jobs, and get results back. Two kinds of parallel apps, one focused on lots of CPU power, HPC, the other, big data, focused on lots of data access. They're both supported on Azure. Why would you do this? The big reason is cost. If I want to do either HPC or big data in my own data center, I've got to buy computers. I've got to have a cluster of servers, maintain those guys. It's really expensive. Here, I can spin up the VMs, either for HPC or big data, when I need them, pay for them while I use them, and shut them down. This is great. Cloud platforms like Azure democratize access to parallel applications. Even small companies can now get access to this kind of computing. This is really a great thing, in my opinion. Also, as I mentioned, there's built-in support for doing this. HPC Server, Windows HPC Server, provides a way to create and manage clusters on Azure for HPC, and HD Insight lets you create and manage Hadoop clusters automatically. That's a big win because the skills required to do Hadoop clusters today are not easy to find. So there you have it. Three big scenarios, three big categories: new employee-facing apps, new customer-facing apps, new parallel apps. I see enterprises using all of these in different combinations on Azure today. Some final thoughts here. As I hope I've shown you, public cloud platforms can provide lower cost and higher reliability for infrastructure and better support, in many cases, for new applications. In fact, I believe this is true. At least one of these scenarios probably has value for every enterprise right now. Let me tell you, I've done this talk many, many times around the world to live audiences of IT leaders. At this point, I always stop and I say, okay, who in the room believes that at least one of these scenarios has value today for your organization? And you know what happens? All the hands go up. And when I ask them which one they want to start with, the most common answers are always the same. It's storage, the store simple scenario. It's VMs for dev test. And increasingly, it's identity with Azure AD. That's a new technology from Microsoft. Less experience with that so far. The point is, my experience, and thus my belief, is that pretty much every enterprise can benefit today from at least one of these scenarios. And so given that, my final thought is this. What are you waiting for? Thank you.
Thank you, David. We can open up to questions now.
Okay, I see some questions here. Let me quickly look through them. There's a long, complex question here about SANS. the guy wants to use SANS with Store Simple. In general, Store Simple lives by itself. It talks to the cloud for back-end storage. Now, he also points out, this is a really good observation. He says, we've got a bunch of SANS. It seems a shame to waste them by not using them. I couldn't agree more. Absolutely true. What I find is that organizations tend to use things like Store Simple rather than buying new SANs. It makes no sense, generally, to take a sunk cost like a SAN or a server or anything else and replace it with Azure. What people do, in my experience, is use Azure for growth, such as Store Simple for new kinds of growth, rather than buying new SANs, and they start moving apps to Azure or using Azure servers, VMs, when it's time to do a hardware refresh. So I'm not suggesting you throw things out by any means. No rational firm would do that. No rational firm would do that. Another question. Can you host Oracle databases on Azure? You can. In fact, it's kind of interesting. One of Azure's main competitors is Amazon Web Services. And Oracle and Microsoft have this deal where Oracle says, we will give official support to our technologies, the database, WebLogic, things like that, on Azure. But they don't officially support those things on Amazon, which is interesting. So the answer to your question is yes, you can definitely do that. And there's a question here about PCI-type compliance requirements. The answer there is it depends. Compliance is so often the kind of question where the real answer is it depends. If you go to Microsoft's website, they've got a trust center that talks about a range of things they support. You can do HIPAA, for example, in the U.S. They agree to the EU model clauses. There's a bunch of stuff here. This topic, however, quickly gets complicated and quickly gets very local. That is, it varies across countries. So as I said before, I really encourage you not to let compliance be a showstopper, but also not to ignore it. I met with an IT leader from a bank in France when I was in Paris a while ago. And he told me that his bank had done this detailed study with their lawyers, and they found they could legally store 90% of their data in Azure. And realize, if you're in Paris, there are no Azure data centers in France. They're in Europe, they're in Holland and Ireland. So in America, it's even better in some ways because Edisons are here in the country. So you want to be aware of that. It's not a simple issue, but don't let it put you off. Don't let it just shut you down. Compliance can be addressed. It can be dealt with. More questions? Anything else? Well, it doesn't look like it. So let me end my part of this by once again thanking all of you for participating. And by the way, if you'd like a PDF of the slides, one will be available later. You're also free to email me. My email is david@davidchappell.com, DavidChappell, two P's and two L's, .com. If you email me and ask for a PDF of today's webcast, I will send it off to you. Okay? So thank you very much. Anusha, back to you.
Thank you, David. Thank you, everyone. This concludes the webinar.